The Secrets of Technology is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to The Secrets of Technology. Hi, I'm Dom Bettinelli, and you're listening to The Secrets of Technology, where we discuss the technology news that's important to you from a uniquely Catholic point of view. And joining me today on the panel are Father Joseph Sund. Hey, Father.
Good to be with you.
And Victor Lambs. Hey, Victor.
Hey, Dom.
Before we get into our show today, I want to tell you all about another show on the StarQuest Network that I'm sure you'll enjoy called The Secrets of Stargate. That's right, a great show with Stargate was, multiple shows. And in fact, if you hop in now, they're about to start talking about Stargate Atlantis as they're talking about the season 8 of the original Stargate SG-1. Right, Victor? Victor's on that show.
That's right. We're moving from some great seasons of Stargate, just finishing up season 7, moving into season 8. And as you mentioned, starting the first spinoff, Stargate Atlantis, which is a great one. So you don't want to miss that.
Yeah, I've been watching ahead of you guys. So I've been really enjoying it. It's Jason Momoa doesn't come into the Stargate Atlantis for much longer than my memory has it. So it's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
I've only ever watched, I watched Stargate SG-1, the original, several times, but I've only ever watched Atlantis once, so it's fun to revisit it. So folks, check that out wherever fine podcasts are found or at sqpn.com/Stargate. So our main topic today is we're going to talk about photo editing and storage. You know, there's lots of stuff out there about taking photos, and I think we've talked about taking photos before and how to take a good photo with your camera, phone, and but I want to talk a little bit about what we do with the photo after we've taken it. How do we keep it safe? You know, it's not like the old days where you took your canister down to the little hut by the strip mall and they developed it for you in a couple of days and you took it home and shoved it in a bin that went in the attic and you took out every Thanksgiving and Christmas and paged through it. Or, you know, if you were better than my family was, you put it in albums and that sort of thing. But it existed. It was physical. It was a thing that was there and you had it. And a lot of our photo, you know, most people taking photos today are taking digital photos and they have a whole other way or need to keep them safe. So tell me, before we get into it, how are you with photography? Do you take a lot of photos? Victor's, and for you and your family, are you the photographer? Is your wife the photographer?
Oh yeah. I'm definitely the, like, kind of the family photographer, and my wife being the artist and graphic artist is definitely the one taking the more arty photos of, you know, plants and flowers and things like that. I take a lot of photos with my phone because I want to capture the moment. I can say that I rarely, if ever, revisit those photos. One exception would be when I take like video with my phone, and then if it's a special event or a trip, I'll edit that down into a short video clip that I'll then put on my Plex server, and the kids enjoy watching that. But I'm curious to hear, like, what people do, what you and Father Sun do with the photos, because I don't tend to revisit my photos, and I think I'd like to.
Father, why don't you tell us about your photo workflow, you know, what you do for photos in general, and whether you are you a photographer? Let's just start there, and then we'll get into the details as we go. But how about you?
You know, I wax and wane on the hobby photography for a couple of years. Haven't done too much. Majority of stuff is by using my phone. I have an iPhone 13. I do have a Canon Rebel, an older one, but honestly, it's usually not worth the effort of assembling it when the photos of your phone are almost better.
I have a Micro Four Thirds, like a Panasonic Micro Four Thirds, with the, you know, a bunch of different lenses, and I never pull it out. I just never use it because, you know, it's the photos can be better, but not so much better that makes it worth it to pull it out.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. Also, the benefit of the iPhone of live photos really helps me, because sometimes my photo taking skills isn't the best. So the fact that I can get 20 shots in one shot kind of helps me out a bit.
We'll talk about that a little bit, because there's a neat trick in there for you. But, Victor, for me, when you ask that question, so in my house, my wife and I both take a lot of photos. And actually now the kids are starting to take a lot of photos as well, as they get, phone plans and phones. So they'll take photos of family stuff. But the one thing, the way I make sure that we see the photos over and over again, well, one of the things I do is I will curate a sort of, for significant events, family events, birthdays or that sort of thing, or parties, or I'll take a bunch of them and throw them in my journal, my day one journal. And so every year I always, every day I go back and look at the previous year's entries. And so I'll see my photos in there. I also have photos, and I'll talk about why, a lot of photos in Amazon's cloud. And because I have an Amazon Echo with a screen, I have it set to showing me photos there as well.
Okay.
So it sits on my desk, and it's like a digital frame, just like we've talked about. The other thing I do is on my iPhone, I've set it so that the wallpaper, the lock screen wallpaper, changes regularly, and I've got it set to family photos. And so it's constantly surfacing photos of my kids, my wife, sometimes they're funny and weird photos. Sometimes they're just really cute photos. I have a lot of photos that show up on, they used to have on Apple TV a great family photo screensaver. I'll have to look and see if they ever brought that back. But there was one that just basically pulled from your entire library, which, if you have a wife like mine who likes to take pictures of flowers a lot and bushes and birds, you get a lot of that. But it used to be great. We would just sit here and stay in with the screensaver running, watching photos roll by. That was always great. There's a variety of ways you can get those photos to show up. The kids, they love to see the old photos, my kids. And sometimes it actually helps, creates memories in them of things that they've never done. Like, they're like, wasn't I there? No, you've just seen the photo so often that you think you were there. Oh, okay. So I wanted to start, I wanted to approach this from a technology platform standpoint. So I want to talk a little bit about Mac and iOS, and then you guys can approach it from a Windows, Android, and Linux perspective. But I had a few things I wanted to mention to folks from the Mac and iOS perspective. First, use iCloud Photo Library. It is, they've had a variety of photo cloud things the past Apple has. This really works well. It's the thing that works well. You take a photo on your phone, it's going to be on your computer, it's going to be in the cloud, it's going to be everywhere. And now that they have shared libraries, oh my gosh, I used to have the most Rube Goldberg-esque system to get the photos that my wife took off of her phone into Dropbox and import it into Photos, in order to preserve, to have all of our photos in one place. Well, now the shared photo library does that, and it's been really great. A couple things: make sure you have an iCloud plan that's big enough for all your family photos. You'd be surprised how quickly they stack up. But also in the camera app, make sure you've turned on shared library so that when you take the photo, it's automatically going into the shared library. Some people, I don't want to put, everything I take ever into the shared library. So I sometimes take pictures of labels and stuff like that, because I'm transferring the information. But keep it on for regular use so that your photos are constantly going in there, and encourage family members. Remember, make sure your shared library is on. We want to get all those photos into the shared library. In the top, when you're in the camera app, there's an icon on the top left of the phone camera for your shared shared library.
Yeah, I use Dropbox just by itself for that. I mean, all of our photos that we take on all of our phones go right into our Dropbox camera feed there as well. So
I think if you have an Amazon Prime membership as well, you can use Amazon Photos. And that gives you unlimited storage as that as well. And so that can give you some access on your phone to not have to use your whole iCloud library.
Well, one of the things I do is because photos are so important, I don't want them to be in just one place. So I have both a Google Photos app and the Amazon Photos app on my phone. And I have Amazon Prime, like you mentioned. With Amazon Prime, you get unlimited photo storage. And so I have it set to automatically upload all of my photos to Amazon. And then Google also uploads all of my photos to their cloud, although you have to pay for the Google cloud space. So that could be an extra cost for you on top of everything else. But my photos are in three places in the cloud. They're in Apple's cloud, Google's cloud, and Amazon's cloud. So that's another tip I want to give you. And this works for, if you have an Android phone, have a Google, the Google cloud and the Android cloud, then, the Amazon cloud, have multiple cloud storage places. If you have an Amazon Prime account, it's a no brainer to do that. And that's the other thing I would say is if you have iCloud, there is a setting where you tell it in the Photos app, you can either have it store all originals here on this computer or only keep thumbnails here and keep the originals elsewhere in the cloud or whatever. And you could technically have it set so that on your Mac and on your iPhone and on your iPad, they're all set to store all the originals in the cloud and not download them anywhere. I don't know. Maybe it's me being a Luddite or maybe me being someone who's worked with a lot of technology over the years. I don't trust the cloud particularly. I want at least one place where all of those photos are downloaded locally on my computer, they're full size and resolution. And then that drive gets backed up in my usual 3-2-1 style, local, three places, two different media, one of them offsite. And so, Backblaze and all that sort of stuff. So, so I've got my photos backed up multiple ways. Just that's the one thing you can't replace is those photos. And that's the danger of it. If you have a Mac that doesn't have a lot of storage space, if you've got a smaller drive, photos and videos take up a lot of space, consider getting a fast SSD, a solid state drive to connect to your Mac. That's what I've done. I have a 1 terabyte Samsung T7 connected to the back of my Mac through the Thunderbolt port, and that's just as fast as an internal drive. And that's where I put the photo library.
I would add on that just being cognizant of ransomware and things, that your photos don't become a victim of that, to do your solid state drive as a air gap drive, which means after you back things up, you unplug it.
You could do that. Yeah. You could have two drives, or you could do, if you don't use your photos all the time, like when you quit the photo app, unplug the, eject the drive, unplug it. Yeah. That's a good point too. If you only use the Photos app on occasion, but keep in mind, if it's unplugged, it's not downloading your latest photos. So you've got make it a habit to plug it in every once in a while to get the latest set of photos that you've been taking. You can have your photo library in a different place like this, but you have to tell the Mac where to do it. So to change photo libraries, you can go into the preferences for photos and select new library, and you tell it this is the new system library. You could have multiple libraries for whatever reason, like separate work and personal or whatever, however you want to do it. But if you want a new system library, you do want to tell it to that. And then sometimes you might be required to go to system settings and turn off iCloud and turn it back on to get it to do it. So just keep that in mind. Yeah. It will tell you if you need to. And then one other thing with the Google Photos and Amazon Photos, make sure you're backing up at original quality. You want it to be taking the full version of the file. You don't want to lose your iPhoto library in the iCloud and then find out the only backups you have are very low resolution thumbnails that it was backing up. That would be almost as bad as just losing them. So just something to keep in mind. Make sure it says original quality. And then for editing photos, I'd say that for most people, the editing controls in Photos is pretty good. In the Photos app that comes with it, for most people, I do generally edit every photo with a certain basic set of changes. I always increase exposure by a couple, like 5 to 10 on the meter, maybe even less. Contrast also, I always bump it up a little bit. Saturation, I bump up a little. And then I like vignetting because I think it draws the eye to the subject of the photo. And so I usually set that to 50, which, kind of brings down the exterior just a little bit.
You're losing data there. You're losing photo data. You can always vignette it. I mean, this isn't a destructive edit, right? This is a copy. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. In Photos, that's an important point. The edits are non-destructive. Yes. You can always walk it back. Once you export it, it sets it. But as long as it's in Photos still. And I don't do that to every single photo. But if I want to make a photo look nice, if I'm going to share it in social media or something like that, I'll tend to do something like that. And that's a personal preference. Those are the settings that just make a photo looks like it pops to me. For other people, it might be a little different. And you'll have to adjust that based on whether you're indoor or outdoor, bright light, dark conditions, that sort of thing. So keep in mind. Father, you mentioned that live photos, the nice thing about live photos is you take a photo and the camera, the iPhone camera, is taking a whole bunch of shots at once, essentially a video. And, it's the one where you hold down, if you hold your finger on the screen, it shows you a few seconds before and after the actual moment of the photo. One thing you can do is if you edit the live photo, you can adjust which is the main frame. So if you got someone with their eyes closed, for instance, you could look for a frame of that little video, one shot where their eyes were open and it was a better shot. So you just go into in Photos, you go into Edit, click on Live Photo, and then you can swipe left and right to find one.
Yeah. Well, one warning about live photos, if you're sending live photos via iMessages to people, it does give them the sound if they long press the photo, which is...
it could be embarrassing.
Sometimes might be embarrassing for people.
Right. That's a good point. It is a video.
Yeah. And on Samsung Android phones, it's called, I think, Motion Photo or something, but they do have the same functionality.
Okay.
On there.
And then the last thing I want to mention are a couple apps for helping you manage your photos. They're both from a company called MacPaw. On the Mac, it's called Gemini, and on iOS, it's called Clean My Phone. And they're basically deduper's. They find duplicate photos, like especially these days where it's so easy to just take 7 photos of the same things when you're looking for one good shot. And it does a bunch of other stuff as well, and it uses AI, which is the buzzword, to help you manage your library. but Gemini will do more than photos, but they both, I think, started as photo management apps. So that's
not to be confused with Google Gemini, which will take all of your photos and swap the the pigmentation on them.
It'll swap the race and gender on all the people in your photos. So that's what I had to say about Mac and iOS. What about Windows? What can we say about photos editing and storage on Windows?
It's laughable.
but Windows really wants you to enable the camera app on it. But yeah, the first thing I do whenever I, update or reinstall Windows is uninstall all of the Windows camera apps and stuff off of it. And they don't need that. So go ahead.
So there is a built-in, as he's mentioning, there is a built-in Windows Photo app. It is one of the most horrendous photo management apps out there. It's clunky. It doesn't get the job done. It ends up giving you way too many duplicates of photos. It insist on doing things to OneDrive. It's not my preferred app, but okay, it is there and it somewhat works. So, there's Adobe Lightroom, Classic, and there's also Adobe Photoshop Elements. Those are going to cost you a pretty penny, like all Adobe products. But those are going to be your top of the line things to be able to use. You could also use those in the Mac, in your Mac environment. There's a piece of software that's an open source piece of software called DigiCam, which cam is spelt with a K. I don't know why, probably because it's originally a Linux piece of software, which they like to sell spell things with K's. So DigiCam is also a Windows piece of software, and that can do some basic photo downloading and organizing. I'm unaware if there's basic editing in there. I haven't played with that for a while. And then, Victor, did you have that buy once alternative there?
So we were getting tired of the Adobe Mafia, but needed something similar to Photoshop as well as Illustrator and, you know, things like that. And so we found this, I think they're French, I'm not sure, this company called Affinity, and they make a photo editor, which is excellent. It's a slightly different paradigm than Photoshop, but it's very comparable. And the good news is you can purchase it once and then use it, you know, for forever. And it's available for Windows, Mac, and iPad. So if you have all platforms, you can buy it once. It's a little bit more expensive that way, and then use it on all the platforms, or you can just buy the iPad version. But especially if you have like one of those fancy, you know, DSLR cameras and are using raw, you know, raw image format, which we sometimes do, it's very good for processing raw images as well. So, if you're looking for an alternative to Photoshop, check out the Affinity Photo Editor, and it might do what you need it to do.
I've used the Affinity for iPad app, and it is a pretty nice iPad app. It has, it, you know, you can do all the photo editing you want for, I think it's $19 they offer it, so it's a pretty good deal. The Adobe products like Lightroom and Photoshop, you can get, they have a bundle, like the photography bundle. It's $10 a month for a subscription. I mean, Lightroom is great. I've used Lightroom for years. I used it in a work environment, and it's got all the tools. It's kind of complicated, like a lot of Photoshop, you know, Adobe tools. It's got a fairly steep learning curve, but once you figure it out, then it becomes second nature. And I think a lot of people forget how hard it was to learn when they're recommending it to other people, because it can be like kind of confusing to use. But it's powerful and it's good, and it, you know, and you can put stuff in the cloud and that sort of thing. But I would say
if you're a newbie, and you want to go with an Adobe product, the Photoshop Elements is probably going to be your safer bet. For
that's probably true. That's true. Yeah, Lightroom is more about organizing, you know, like a library, but also has editing tools in it. But Photoshop Elements is more about editing the photo and fixing things. So, but check out Affinity. I mean, it could be the thing for you. How about on Android? What do we have there for photo editing and storage and that sort of thing?
Yeah, so it's going to depend on the manufacturer of your Android phone as well as the version, because you know, camera apps and camera capabilities vary from phone to phone. I've been using Samsung phones for a little while now and LG phones before that. Samsung really invests in the quality of their cameras and their photo apps. I would say it's probably what they invest in the most. So they're all very good. You can do tons of basic editing in the photos. I never really have to tweak the photos because the AI in the camera itself is generally very good. Most of the photo editing apps you'll find on Android are you know, their paid apps or their subscription apps, so I don't bother with them. Google has their Snapseed app, which may still be on Mac as well. I use that if there's any sort of, you know, vignetting or little effects that I need to do.
Yeah, it's then, on iOS. I still have that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's a good, you know, evergreen app. And then, you know, on iOS as well, I tend to play around with the apps that make your photos look like they've been digitized onto an old 8-bit computer or a Game Boy. So, you know, there's various 8-bit apps that you can find on Android as well. So those are kind of fun just to, if you grew up with a Commodore 64 and looking at digitized photos in, you know, 4 or 16 colors, you can recreate that with your cherished family memories.
One of these days we'll have to do a show on just like fun tools for photos, you know, where you can take people out, put things in, change it, filters, that sort of stuff. That'd be a fun discussion. Cool. So there are a couple of web-based tools I wanted to mention that I use. Father, you brought this one to my attention, the Tiny Wow tools, tinywow.com. They have a whole set of image tools, and these are all like very single purpose tools. Like they're very targeted at a particular use, and their image tools are really great. So they have an AI image generator like everybody does now, but you can do things like remove backgrounds. Like, and a lot of these things you can do in other software, more comprehensive packages. So I should point that out, but these, you know, are very targeted. So you could take a PDF and make it a JPEG. One of the things that you could do is the iPhone takes photos in the HEIC image format, which is fine unless you want to share it with anyone who's also in an Apple ecosystem. So they have an HEIC to JPEG converter, you know, that sort of thing. I use the WebP to JPEG converter a lot. When I'm doing cover art for our various shows, sometimes I'll grab a screenshot off of Google Images, but it comes down as a WebP image, and I'll need to convert it so I can use it. But things like unblurring and cropping and colorizing and all those sorts of things, there's dozens of tools here. So you just check it out. Some of them are pretty esoteric, but some of them are pretty cool, and I'm sure at least one of them will be useful for you. So mention that. And then another one I recently discovered, and it was so good, I'm actually paying for it. It's called the AI Image Upscaler. And I got a subscription for the use with the SQPN shows. What it does is it takes an image that is low resolution and it will enlarge it. It will upscale it to 2x and 4x. And in the process, it will also denoise and deblur it, like make it sharper, but not like just like turning a sharper, you know, the sharpness dial in Photoshop. It does it sort of intelligently. What I found is it mainly focuses that denoising. It focuses on faces. So the like around eyes and mouth and, you know, that sort of thing. It can do some remarkable stuff. So a lot of, like some of our shows like Stargate or Star Trek, they were shot in the pre-HD era. So sometimes the screenshots are kind of low res. And I just don't love the low res look of, in our cover art. So what I do now is I'll bring those images over here and I can, you know, upsize them and, you know, make them, you know, 1080 or 4K images very easily. You just drag a photo into the box on the site and it enlarges it to 2X. And if you want it to go even more, you just hit the 4X button. So you get a handful of images for free. But I was using it enough where I'm like, you know what, I'm going to need a little bit more than that. So I did subscribe to it. There's also a Mac app, which I could have got, but the web interface works for me. It works fine. I don't do so many that I need an app on my computer to do it. So if you ever have a need for, you know, using images that are fairly low res, like if you have like old digital photos that you took with old digital cameras, you know, the ones like some of the early models, like those Olympus OM, what, 10s, whatever is those, some of the earlier ones, they had 640 by 480 images. And those photos are pretty low res now. you could use a tool like this to upscale it and to make it more presentable. So something to think about. And then any other Linux tools that you wanted to mention, Father?
Oh, there's plenty of Linux ones. You can find a whole repository of them. But again, Digicam was one. Shotwell is more of an organizing tool. It kind of reminds me of the your old iPhoto app before it got all iClouded. The Darktable is a non-destructive editor. And so gives you some of those functions of a Photoshop, but more meant for photography, not as much like GIMP would be for the Photoshop, but it's a non-destructive one. And then nice little utility called Rapid Photo Downloader, which is really good for your SD cards and Android phones. iPhones are a little tough sometimes to import because they purposely do that, I think. But so those are
okay.
Some little tools there, but a
great
little higher entry level on those to of skill.
Well, it's
they're
Linux.
Not easy.
Linux is already a little bit higher entry level. So if you've gotten as far as installing and running day to day in Linux, you'd probably be fine with these. And that's we're just scratching the surface. You know, we could do a whole, you know, show called The Secrets of Digital Photography and talk about it day after day after day. So we're just kind of scratching the surface. If you've got a tip or hack or app or something you want to recommend, we'd love to hear from you and share it in a future episode. You can send that to technology@sqpn.com or visit our Discord community at sqpn.com/discord and join our very active Secrets of Technology channel there and share it with us there. We'd love to hear from you. So moving on, before we get to our headlines, I want to take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create the Secrets of Technology, including Martin G., Tim D., Sean F., John C., and Patrick. Their generous tax-deductible donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue the Secrets of Technology and all the shows at StarQuest, and you can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. So our first headline is interesting. This is right in our wheelhouse. The headline is Power of the Podcast, Priest Parishes Finding New Ways to Connect with the Flock, from the Detroit Catholic, right from your neck of the woods here, Victor.
Yay.
And in fact, you know some of the folks involved in this. But basically the story is about how this, at least this one parish is, and there are others as well, apparently, but profiles this one parish that is using the power of podcasting to help the priests connect with their communities, the parishioners, because, you know, in a lot of ways, most people, they only know their pastors, or the priests from, you know, 40 minutes on Sunday in a homily. And this is a way to get to know them a little better. So and then they talked about some of the other podcasts that the Archdiocese of Detroit is doing, which is great. I was really pleased to see all that they're doing. Full disclosure, I used to work for the Archdiocese of Boston in the digital media department. And we had a radio show that we did as a podcast, but we hadn't really got to the point of official podcasts like this. And I also worked in a parish as a director of communications. And again, I would have loved to have been able to do some of what they're doing. It looks really impressive. Mm-hmm. So what do y'all think of this one?
I've played with the idea a few times, especially being in a rural area. For a long time, doing homilies on podcasts used to get a lot of hits. It doesn't anymore.
No.
It's kind of died out. It was worth my effort kind of prior to COVID that we would maybe get 50 people or so listening to it, which at a parish level is good. Okay. But at this point, it's not worth upkeeping. But to be able to have discussions and have a longer and more meaningful conversations, and maybe even to pull in people from different walks of life in the parish is a good idea to for evangelization and stuff.
I love the idea of people getting to know their priests as just guys, regular guys. I lived in a church rectory for a number of years, and it was really a great way to getting to know the priests, you know, just as guys. You hang out, have a beer, and listen to the ball game, and hear the stories of their lives. And some of these guys have amazing stories. And I think priests underestimate how cool they are, you know, and how fascinating they can be to their parishioners. They want to know you. And I mean, I like the idea of the homily, because there are times when I've heard a homily and I'm like, you know, I wish I could hear that again, because there's something really good there. But beyond the homily, I want to know the people. I want to know the man. And I think I love the idea that, especially as fewer and fewer priests are out there, you know, getting spread out a lot more, we're going to get less and less opportunity to meet you guys, you know, outside of shaking your hand on the way out of church. This is a great way to get to know the priests and to hear from them. So, Victor, how about you? What do you think of this one?
Yeah, I think it's great. I mean, I follow a lot of priests on X who are very interesting. Certainly more interesting than I remember priests being on social media or Twitter. You know, I guess it's just a different generation. But yeah, so I like that. Podcast too. Like I wish that, you know, they would have podcasts and stuff. The article mentions Father John Ricardo, who listeners may be familiar with from Ave Maria Network, or I think some of the stuff on EWTN Radio Network, but he has a new ministry called Acts 29. And they do a lot of, you know, they do a lot of events. One of his recent things that he started is the Rescue Project, which is a retreat type event. But he actually has a podcast, and I was poking around on our Roku device, and there's actually an Acts 29 Roku app that you can add and stream, a dedicated Roku app. And he was the priest at he was the parish, you know, priest at the at a parish at our family parish for a while. And my sister-in-law actually works for Acts 29 as like a hospitality and event coordinator there. So definitely excellent. You know, with Catholic radio is pretty prevalent on the AM band, but if you don't live in an area that has, you know, good Catholic radio, this is and of course the StarQuest podcasts are a good way to catch up.
Well, and radio, you know, I hate to say, is not as prevalent among younger generations. For them, it's podcasting. And so if you want to reach a younger crowd, you're going to have to find new ways, whether it's TikTok or podcast or YouTube. You gotta go where the people are at. Now, that doesn't mean you ignore the people who are, you know, who are already there. But I like the idea of, you know, record once and distribute many, you know, and have reaching people. You know, create the content once and then repurpose it in many different places. But I love the idea of getting to know priests and the staff, the folks at the parish, the director of religious formation and the director of evangelization. And I looked at the Detroit Archdiocese has a podcast called Beyond Sunday, which is says podcast for busy families and parents. There's a Men of the Heart, which is a vocational discernment podcast. I mean, it's really kind of cool to see all the things that they're doing there. So it's really awesome.
I remember my my first like interaction with a priest that was realizing that priests were real people was I was working in youth ministry, and I didn't even realize like that a lot of priests were real people, and opened the idea of further of vocation to the priesthood. And it was talking about Battlestar Galactica with a priest, chatting about that at that point the new Battlestar Galactica was far superior to the old ones.
Yes. Yes. Well, and that's one of the reasons why we do StarQuest and why we talk about things that aren't, you know, necessarily directly faith related, like Star Trek and Doctor Who and whatever. It's because, hey, Catholics can be interested in this sort of thing too. You get to know us. You get to know the priests in our network, which is, I think, a great vocational discernment thing. I wish we could get some religious sisters on our podcast, frankly, if there are any out there who would like to, you know, commit to being with us, talk about Star Wars or that sort of thing. I would love to hear from you, but I think it's great to get to know people or bishops, by the way. By the bishops are welcome as well. So, in any case, that would be very interesting. Let's move on to our next headline. This one comes out of the Atlantic, and it's called, the headline is America's Last Morse Code Station. I just thought this was cool. So, back in 1999, the last vestiges of commercial, you know, government Morse code was, the maritime Morse code stations, where they communicated ships at sea, you know, to ship to shore and that sort of thing. And, but it got phased out in 1999. But these radio enthusiasts out in California, out near San Francisco, got together to preserve the last radio station, you know, Morse code stations out there. And they continue to exist at the Point Reyes National Seashore, KPH Maritime Radio. And they call themselves the Radio Squirrels. And it's just a handful of volunteers who maintain the equipment and continue to broadcast. They say that they, every Saturday, they Morse code out the maritime news and weather reports and that sort of thing. I kind of love it. I mean, what do you guys think? This, I don't know if it's just me, old guy, you know, nostalgia, yeah. But it's kind of love it.
Yeah, I mean, if you see the pictures of the Radio Squirrels, they definitely are a vanishing breed there. I mean, the time was, I think, part of the ham radio license requirements was that you did know Morse code. They dropped that a long time ago. So I think there's probably a lot of like older ham radio operators out there that still know Morse code, but definitely not very many, you know, stations, radio stations that exist for that, you know, purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
One thing you'll find is a lot of scouts, Boy Scouts still will learn Morse code. I don't think it's a merit badge anymore. I have to check if communication still requires it. But still, it's scouts do it. And in fact, one of the pictures they show, you know, and the article talks about a young man, 17, who's checking out the Radio Squirrels. And I'm like, that's the next generation there. It's kind of fun.
Talks about how they have to call eBay for parts.
Yes, because some of these machines are so old. I know what happens when you get to the point where hopefully we'll have 3D printing technology at the level once these parts are all gone, where you can 3D print new tubes and stuff.
Yeah. Talk about our sponsor PCBWay. No, I'm just kidding.
If you go to their website, which I'll also have a link to, there's a lot about the history of the Morse code stations and this one in particular, but others in general. And they talk about how at one point their station was made responsible for the East Coast Cape Cod station, WCC, and, which is located where Marconi did the first transatlantic broadcast. I've been there several times. It's on the Cape Cod National Seashore, and it is pretty wild, pretty amazing to think, you know, this old technology. We take it for granted. We can communicate with anyone in the world instantaneously, and there was a time when that wasn't so, and they had to find these other ways of doing it. I thought it was fascinating that in the 40s, is San Francisco station was running a Cape Cod station, and I'm not, was over phone lines. I mean, how would you do that back then? That's kind of fascinating. I don't know how that would work. So if anyone knows, let me know. I'd appreciate it. And finally, our last headline, it comes from the National Catholic Register, and it is artificial intelligence. AI can create religious images in seconds, but is it really sacred art? And we've talked about AI art in the past on the show, and this article came out earlier in February, and I saw it all over the place. And the writer here, Joseph Pronishin, sorry, Joseph, but he interviewed a bunch of artists, sacred artists, and to get their opinions on sacred, you know, the AI art and sacred art. And what do y'all think of the article, which the basic premise is AI cannot create sacred art. Whatever they create is not art, and it's not sacred. What do you think?
Well, I live with an artist, as I mentioned before, my wife, who actually does, you know, sacred art. She has a business selling, you know, sacred art and graphic design. So I asked her for her opinion on this. Certainly the artists that they mentioned Daniel Matsui, who they interviewed for the article, certainly someone whose work I've respected and admired for years. And she basically came to the same conclusion that, you know, AI can create images, but is not creating art. Mm-hmm. The subtle distinction. And I think they explain this pretty well in the article. You know, it's basically synthesizing images based on, you know, what it's been trained on. Whereas an artist, you know, is using their experience, their emotions, their talent as a person, and can create something unexpected, that, you know, an AI image generator, although, you know, amusing, I've used it to create, you know, images, and my kids have used it to create images of Daleks fighting the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. amusing, but not really art in any sense. So, no, it's a very interesting piece. And I thank you for bringing it to my attention.
I think I figured out why AI can't figure out hands and things is that it's actually reading from the Book of Revelation, and it's looking at these angels with multiple heads. And so that's how it's been portraying hands. Some of these images, you see their folded hands with eight fingers on one hand. And it's,
yeah, they're getting better at it, though. More recent versions of the models have fixed those sorts of things, which is good. You know, there's a definition given by one of the artists interviewed in the article. She says that sacred art is the work of a trained artist cooperating with the grace of inspiration to create a visual description of a supernatural reality, which is, I think, is a pretty decent definition of sacred art. And I guess I would compare what AI is doing, the machine language models are doing, is they are the equivalent of motel room art, you know, just these machine produced random abstract pieces that random landscapes or whatever, that just like they're just there to break up the vast expanse of the wall of a cheap motel room, you know. It's not art per se, even if it is, you know, an image on a canvas.
Yeah, my wife did say that one good aspect to artists of this is that a lot of the annoying requests that an artist or a graphic designer would get, like, hey, can you Photoshop an image of a dog riding a unicycle for me real quick? Yeah. You don't get those anymore, because now AI is getting that kind of, you know, pop product, you know, sludge that otherwise they would go to a graphic designer for. And, you know, the graphic mm-hmm. designer would feel a little bit of their soul die as they would, you know, Photoshop the dog out of the unicycle. I mean, it will create less work for artists. And, you know, if all you need is that kind of, you know, that product, but, you know, let the artists do art is, you know, my point of view.
I have to admit, like, we've used AI based art in episode artwork for several of our shows, including this one, mostly because a lot of the time I'll go to a stock photo site and they just don't have what I'm looking for. It's the same thing every stock photo site. If you look for a picture of a family eating, I love to give this example, family eating dinner, it'll be a mom, a dad, a boy and a girl, a roast chicken and corn. That's family eating dinner. And like the race changes, you know, the hair colors change, but it's the same. It's the same thing. And so it's like, I want something a little different. And so I will often turn to I use Midjourney for what we use. But even then, it's sometimes hard to get the darn thing to give me what I'm looking for. If I could just talk to a human being and say, what I need is an image of a Roswell gray alien dressed in papal robes. That seems like a very straightforward request. I could, for the life of me, could not get the darn thing to give me that. And eventually we turned to an actual artist. And we actually had a supporter of the network. They recommended a friend of theirs, and they paid their friend to create a bit of art for us of a alien as a pope for Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. So, you know, I understand, like, I agree for the most part, but there are parts of the story that kind of frustrated me a little bit. You know, the complaints about, they talk a lot about in this about how AI can't render hands properly, or it gives the wrong theological imagery. But all that can be, all that will get better over time. Yeah. I mean, it will learn how to do, render hands. It will learn what proper theological imagery it can learn. Anyway, it can be taught, can be programmed by a human being to know the, what proper theological symbolism and imagery is. So that's not a great argument against AI sacred art. So I was a little disappointed there. And it kind of leads to a point, which is so much of the discussion in this space is artists who don't know a lot about technology talking about it. And then you have a lot of technologists who don't know a lot about art coming from the other point of view.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like we need to bring the people together and they need to learn the other side.
So I think about the areas of art that we're losing artisans in, that we things like stone carving and things like that. And is there ways in which AI and 3D printing and different things can do those things, in which I think of when we do construction now, the amount of buildings that just have really bland building features going on. And is there something mm-hmm. that we can do that with a computer and technology to build where the artisan skill has disappeared from the face of the earth, really?
Yeah, I mean, you can always do 3D scans of existing statues, and you can find, you know, thousands of those. If you go to any, like, you know, 3D printing or 3D model site, you find people have gone to museums or gotten artwork and have done 3D scans of some pretty good religious art. And there's no reason why you wouldn't be able to, you know, print that and have that, you know,
right.
You know, as in your building or something. So that's one option.
Like when you're rebuilding the Notre Dame in Paris after the fire, you know, and you need to recreate the gargoyles. And if you don't, they did thankfully have stonemasons that they could rely on. But what if we didn't? Would it be okay to have a computer guided, you know, stone chiseling tool that recreated the gargoyles exactly from reference images we had? I mean,
maybe if you were building like condominiums and calling them like Notre Dame condominiums or something, I don't know. I expect a little bit more out of a cathedral, but I suppose, I mean, if that was the only option of it, I mean, at that point, I mean, just do something different. I mean,
recreate it differently. Yeah. You know, when you talk about artisans disappearing, it brought to mind this story I saw a while ago. The Channel Islands in the English Channel, Guernsey and Jersey specifically, they have these brass or copper milk jugs that are very specific to the island. And there's one guy left who makes them, you know, and he's looking for an apprentice. And that was what the article was about. Like, someone who he wants to come and learn how to do this, preserve this art form. There was another one I saw about a guy, Native American, making one of the last guys making traditional lacrosse sticks from the traditional Native American version, not the mass produced ones we have now, you know, and passing that on. Well, there is a lot of art that is disappearing, and we could use technology to help preserve the art so that we can train new artists, but maybe not have the mm-hmm. machines make the art.
There are probably a lot of really excellent buggy whip makers, you know, back in the late 19th century too.
Right.
I mean, not everything needs to be preserved, but certainly, I mean, we have lost a lot.
Yeah. I mean, like the guys preserving the Morse code stations, like we don't need Morse code stations, but it's a nicer world if we have it. Yeah. I feel like the article would have been better if they'd found some people who were okay with AI art. Like if they'd kind of, I don't think balance is always necessary in journalism in the sense of like, we have to have an equal number of people on both sides because not every not every issue requires balance, let's say. But in this case, I felt like it would have, the article would have been better served if we'd had more perspectives on the issue.
Yeah. It's kind of one, it's a one-sided article. I would agree on that.
Well, I mean, they talked to, you know, human artists. They didn't interview ChatGPT. I think just because it's sacred art too, or Grok or Gemini. Grok, can you create sacred art? No, I think it's, and because it is sacred art, which speaks to man or humankind's relationship with God, it's a specifically sensitive and intimate topic. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I believe that, you know, AI art is demonic as some people believe. And it does come up in the article too, you know, with the computer creating the images and you don't see what's going on in the process, is there a chance that, you know, demons could infiltrate the process at some point? I mean, I don't think so. But, and I think there's plenty of, you know, really disturbed artists, human artists out there as well. Yeah. So
a prominent case recently of a sacred artist who is really demonic.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Even sacred artists can be demonic. I don't know that we need to look to computers for that. So
I've had on our show, Thomas Sanjurjo has been an advocate of, you know, he thinks that AI art should be considered an art form. I would love to get his perspective. Maybe I'll try to wrangle a way to bring this up next time he's on, because I do think there are people who will make allowance for it. And there are very strong feelings like this is a subject I can't bring up in my house because my wife and my daughter get very angry at me as I try to have a discussion about it. They are very firmly against the idea that machine language models can create any type of art.
If ChatGPT writes a poem, is it literature?
Right. Yeah. I've sometimes tried to argue, not as that I believe it, but to offer as an alternative, is it just a tool that the programmer is using to make the art? And that kind of comes up in the article in the sense of at one point, one of the artists says, you know, you can't, it's all digital art and it can only be art if you're using paint and gold leaf and stone. And if it, you know, you can hold it. Because that sort of raises the question, can a human using an iPad with a Apple Pencil make sacred art?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think AI, and this was my wife's point of view from an artist, someone who does digital art.
Yeah.
You know, AI generated art is a tool. It can create images, but it's not a replacement for art. And so I have to defer to her on that. So
I'd almost say it's like, you know, you could create a machine that nurses a child, but you can't create a mother. That with that bond, you know, that loves a child through nursing, there is something lost when you've mediated it through a machine learning model. So, you know, I have my issues with the article itself, but I am in general agreement with the artists on that. So,
And check out Daniel Matsui's art. It's very good.
Daniel Matsui is awesome. Yeah. I love his stuff. He recently came out with a new line of products like cups, like coffee mugs with some of his artwork on it, which is really cool. Battle elephants. I'm going to say that, but battle elephants. Just go look it up. Daniel, I'll put a link to Daniel Matsui's website in the show notes. All right. So that's our headlines. And let's move on to our picks of the week. Victor, why don't you go ahead with your pick this week?
Yeah, so mine's a little esoteric and won't be for everyone, but I'm a big fan of Akai, A-K-A-I. Their hardware, they've been making MPC samplers, which have been used in hip-hop music. You can tell them right away because they have these square drum pads on them that you use with finger drumming and stuff. And I have some of their keyboard controllers, too. But what I needed was something very small and compact that could fit, you know, just above my keyboard on my desk that I could use, you know, when I'm editing or when I need to, you know, mute my microphone or tweak a synth or something and don't have room to put, you know, the full, you know, keyboard or, you know, on my desk. And so I picked up there, it's under $60, their LPD 8 Mark II. LPD stands for laptop pad something or other. Yeah, so it's a LPD8, and it's basically just a very small MIDI controller that has eight of their, you know, drum pads on it, eight dials, and you can use it with anything that accepts MIDI messages to use for shortcuts, editing, that sort of thing. And on Windows today, I found an app called MIDI Key to Key. And what it does is it actually maps incoming MIDI messages to keystrokes or keyboard shortcuts on your computer. So you can actually use now any MIDI controller that you might have to, you know, do any sort of keyboard commands in any of your applications as well. So increases the functionality. Again, not going to be for everyone, but if you need, you know, if you find yourself needing buttons and dials for anything, it's an inexpensive and compact way to do it.
Yeah, it's like Stream Deck. You know, you could use it like I use my Stream Deck, except simpler and yeah. You know, without the mini screens and stuff like that. That's cool. Very nice. Father Joseph, what's your pick this week?
Well, I'm going to stay on the topic of keyboards. My pick is it's the Ree Wireless Mini Keyboard. Especially I do quite a little bit of work with Raspberry Pis and stuff. And so having a handheld keyboard that has a touchpad mouse on it and just a real easy functionability is a nice little thing to have. So this particular one, it's $21. Yeah, it's simple, nice. But it's...
It's wireless, so Bluetooth. Right?
It does not run Bluetooth. It does require a 2.4 gigahertz dongle still. So.
Oh, okay. Okay. That can be good, too, because Bluetooth can be a little finicky at times, I found. But nice.
Yeah, this would be perfect for media PCs as well, too, if you have like a PC that you use to watch stuff on and you're always needing a keyboard or something to
use it. Got, like several different... like. It's got a D-pad. It's got a roller, you know, so you could spin it.
That is very cool.
I would just spin it just to, for while I'm, you know, sitting there because it would be a fidget.
Play Pong or something with it. Yeah.
And then it's got a trackpad. So very nice. Yeah. That's a nice inexpensive little keyboard. So my pick has to do with the fact that in a month, basically a month from a month and a day, as you might be getting this, the last major total solar eclipse of the sun, which is what a solar eclipse is. I repeat myself. The last total solar eclipse in the United States will be occurring on April 8th through a grand swath of the central part of the United States.
Wait, the last eclipse?
Sorry, the last. I got myself.
You know something we don't know?
Yeah. The last eclipse for our lifetimes in the United States.
Oh, man.
Unless you're a very young listener. The next one, I think, is like in... like I forget when they said it was, but it's like decades away. So probably the last me anyway. But it's the last for a long time. And so the eclipse is coming, and it's, you know, everyone says who's ever seen a total solar eclipse, not even a partial, but if you've ever seen a total solar eclipse, it is a life-changing experience. And it's hard to explain just what it's like to be there when the eclipse happens. There are things you need to do in order to prepare for your solar eclipse. But one of the most important things you need to do is protect your eyes, because you cannot look at the sun directly. You'll burn out your retinas. That
would be life-changing.
That is definitely life-changing. The thing is, like, the last time there was a solar eclipse a few years ago, there were lots and lots of solar eclipse glasses being sold online on Amazon, whatever. And many of them claim to have the right... what is the right code, the right something FC, UFC code for, and they were fake. Go to eclipseglasses.com and do it right away, because we're going to be running out of time, running out of glasses. Yeah, the ISO standard, the ISO 12312-22 or something like that. Go get your eclipse glasses from them. And you can get them in bulk. I have a large family, so I got a pack of 10 for, you know, not too much money. And we're going to make a ride probably up to New Hampshire or Maine on the 8th to try to catch the eclipse as it travels through New England. Hopefully we will not have the typical New England weather that we've been having the last 3 weeks.
It's coming up quick here.
Clouds. But you know, fingers crossed. But get your Eclipse glasses now, and the eclipseglasses.com is a reputable source where you will make sure you'll get the right thing. A friend of the show who's been on with us before, Jeff Geerling, recently did an episode talking about the Eclipse and preparing and some fun things to do. He had a friend on who has an app for Android and iOS. And I'm kind of doing this on the run here because I forgot to do. He's got an app called Solar Eclipse Timer. And what you, when you launch it on the day of the eclipse, you give it permission to check your location, and then it will calculate all of the things that you should be looking for as they occur during the eclipse from your location. You know, what to be looking for, what you will be seeing, and that sort of stuff. So I'll also put a link to that in the show notes, the Solar Eclipse Timer app. So very good. All right. So though that's our picks of the week, and that is our show. We would love to know what you thought of any part of our discussion today. You can let us know by commenting on the show at sqpn.com/technology or the StarQuest Facebook page, facebook.com/StarQuestMedia. Send an email to technology@sqpn.com. or visit the StarQuest Discord community at sqpn.com/discord. You can find links from our discussion and our picks of the week on our show notes at starquest.fm/247. Sorry, starquest.fm/TEC247. Got to put the tech in there. And be sure to take a moment and help us out by writing a review of the show. I don't think we've had a review in ages on Apple Podcasts or any of the podcast directories. So please take a moment, if you've got just a moment, to write a review. That really helps a lot. And share the podcast with your friends. Help us grow this community and reach more listeners. Until next time, Victor Lambs, thank you for joining me in sharing the secrets of technology.
Thanks, Dom, and bring back the sun.
And Father Joseph Sund, thank you as well.
You're welcome. No clever comment.
And once again, I'm Dom Bettinelli. Thank you for listening to The Secrets of Technology on StarQuest.